Are we recording?
Yes.
We are indeed. Oh, good.
Excellent.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome back to Discursion episode 7. Today we're talking about Alexei Garland's film Krystalyov My Car! Exclamation mark. I have to say that right to shout it.
Krystalyov Mashinu.
Mashinu.
Yeah. I'm Stephen.
And I'm Dominic, and we're very lucky to have a guest again, as like last time. We enjoyed it so much last time, we thought we'd have another guest. So we have Miguel Gagliotti, who has just recently finished his PhD at University of Bristol.
Hello.
So congratulations to Miguel.
Thank you so much.
What do we say about how do we get into this film? So, Alexei German, I think he was born 1938. And died 2013. So was active in both the Soviet and post-Soviet cinema. Didn't make a great deal of films.
No.
I haven't seen his earlier films. I've seen the three sort of latest, but that spans about sort of 30 years or so of his career. I think he was talked about at one point as the kind of heir to Tarkovsky, but that's also misleading because they're extremely different.
Yeah.
I couldn't even begin to give a plot summary.
I guess it's worth mentioning the historical background. It's set against the Doctor's Plot, which Stalin started to construct, I think, between 1948 and 1953. The assertion was that Jewish doctors were plotting to kill senior Soviet officers through medical malpractice, which was later admitted to be a fabrication.
Yeah, so it was a kind of anti-Semitic sort of purge, but then came to nothing because Stalin died, and I think his successors went, this is absurd, let's just quietly let it go. Is that right? That's the same
thing. It was an example of anti-Semitism and also an example of, I guess, anti-USA sentiment, because the State of Israel had just been founded, and there was the rumour was that a lot of these Jewish doctors were acting on the behest of the American government.
But also just general paranoia, presumably, personally, from Stalin.
Yeah,
I get the impression.
But the Krystalyov is centred around one general who is... he gets swept up in this doctor's plot and goes from being quite a celebrated individual to being abducted his character goes through a very tragic arc and by the end of the film which takes place I think it takes place around a decade after Stalin has died. You see him sort of re-entering life as this rather battered, weathered individual. That's the best I can do in terms of plot summary history.
I kind of feel it's actually misleading. When I said I couldn't even begin to summarise the plot, you've done a good job of outlining some of it, and I think we could summarise the plot in more detail. I think the problem is more that wouldn't get anywhere near the experience of watching the film.
Yeah, that's it.
No, that's right.
Could we try and describe something of the experience of watching it, if you know, ignoring the plot unless it's helpful.
Well, yeah, it doesn't feel like purely working in the abstract. You know what I mean? It does. Yeah.
I mean, what about can we start with the cinematography or the way it's? Because it has lots of if we want to do make some use of the Tarkovsky comparison, don't know how helpful it is, but you could say, okay, here's another film by a Russian director which makes much very heavy use of very choreographed long takes.
Yeah.
But with nothing like the contemplative side of Tarkovsky, right?
Or Bellatar, for example.
Or Bellatar, yeah. Right. Yeah, so sometimes it looks more like Bellatar, but again, it's so hectic.
I feel like if you could get just freeze frames, you know, you could say that, but once you get them in movement, there's a sense of like frenzy, like you say, and also like you said anxiety earlier, which I definitely agree with. The grotesque, carnivalesque, you know, like
absolutely
a sort of
grotesque.
Yeah, which is completely non-Bellatar, and also like the sort of dirtiness, the
There is some grotesque in Bellator.
Yeah, I would say, yeah, I think you're right, yeah. There is some grotesque.
But this has a kind of...
But there's a sort of beauty as well, a compositional beauty, which I guess you could say there's, you know, I mean, here it does look quite, you know, it's looks quite put together. I mean, there is effort and decisions gone into the aesthetics and the visuals, but...
You know, it's not slow cinema, is it?
No, absolutely not.
It's almost... Yeah, there's a kind of too muchness, isn't there?
Yeah, it's not... which comes from the mise-en-scene and the acting, I would say. A lot of the pace and yeah.
So this very much seems that, as I said, the ones that I've seen, so the film before this, My Friend Ivan Lapshin, and then this, and then Hard to Be a God, they all very much have the German style. Like, this is... Clearly his, you know, mature aesthetic. Yeah, well, two specific things that they both have, they all have, and this definitely has. So one is that it does have all these, like, really complicated, clearly very rehearsed long takes, even though they seem so chaotic. So you're in these overcrowded apartments and characters are running past the screen and suddenly shout something that seems completely unconnected to anything or all that. But they never separate themselves off as long takes for you to notice them as long takes. Like, I find it almost impossible to predict when the cuts are going to come in this film. Whereas again, with a Tarkovsky or a Bellator, you have the sense to go, I am noticing this take, and it's going to come to an end, and it's a sort of... Whereas I don't... Well, personally, I don't feel that with this.
No. And there also seems to be, like... Or there doesn't seem to be a sort of... display of virtuosism in the length of the take, right? You never get that feeling of, oh, that was a really long and complex you know, very carefully put together. Like, you would get also with, say, somebody like Theo Angelopoulos as well, right?
That sort of... Who I believe Angelopoulos in 1998, when this is from, when this was nominated for the Palme d'Or, Angelopoulos won the Palme d'Or, I think, which is... I'm not sure what that tells us, but... yes, I mean... Having said that, you can watch it for that if you want to, but you really have to
Put yourself out of it's not shouting at you, look at this long take, you know. Yeah, no, it's not.
Not at all.
And I'm sure there's even, like, I mean, I would need to sort of study it in that regard, but I'm sure there are actually short takes in it, right? You know, it's not like, you know, like Angelopoulos or someone that is only long takes,
right? Exactly.
It's part of the way in which he edits is that there are short takes mixed with long takes.
You know? Yes. Yeah. It's quite unusual. I mean, I think it's really quite striking.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I can't think of any... Well, maybe I just don't know, but I can't easily think of anybody who operates quite like... I mean, I think this film looks... Obviously, we can make connections as we've been doing, but I don't...
No, it's definitely a unique style, I would say.
Yeah. Most of the connections, as soon as I say them, I also then want to go, but that's misleading because it's not like that.
Yeah.
I'm just going to say, just because I said two things. The second thing, which gets played much more heavily in Hard to Be a God, but is still noticeable in this, is the propensity for characters to look directly into the camera.
Again, in a non, you know, feels to me at least, in a not very calling attention, you know what I mean? It doesn't feel like it's making a point, like a, you know, you should, I mean, sometimes it's ironic, sometimes it's a bit, like in this film at least, sometimes they look at it as in, that was funny, wasn't it? Sort of, there's a sense of claustrophobia, I would say, and also a sense of, I mean, this might sound very sort of generic, but a sense of lack of control, right? Like, you feel like you're at mercy of, you know, chaos, you know? You know what I mean? Yes. Like, there's a sense of, you know...
Yeah. But it's, I guess there's these contradictory things throughout on there, because there's... Yes, there's a sense of chaos, but then you can, if you pay attention to it, you can see how absolutely... I don't get the sense there's... much improvisation at all. I mean, maybe in micro, but the blocking is where characters have to be and where the camera is clearly very precise. But then that doesn't, it doesn't just feel like a very, very controlled way of showing you something not controlled. It can somehow feel uncontrolled.
Yeah.
Even though it isn't.
Yeah, exactly. Like, for example, do you remember that shot when he gets, I think he gets poured or he gets poured, tea or something, and then the other person holds the glass and then he takes it and that bit falls and then they laugh. It feels unrehearsed, you know what I mean? Like, the reactions, the way it happens, it does feel very much spontaneous. But like you say, there's a sense of prefabrication or you know, premeditation in everything. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. It'd be interesting to get some insight into how he actually directs, if he is very hands-on with each individual actor, or if he just gives them a sort of something to riff on, an idea of what their character is, and just says, now go, and he captures whatever he captures. Mm. Probably somewhere, it's probably somewhere in the middle.
Mm. That is interesting. My feeling is not that. I may be, maybe totally wrong. My feeling is like everybody's got their light. Well, maybe there's something else to say that I think contributes to the feel of this is the style of the dubbing.
Yeah, I was going to say
that. I mean, there's no sync sound, is there, in the whole film?
I don't think so, no. And you can clearly tell that there's many moments where characters are sort of not facing you, where dubbing has been placed, which makes them say things or do noises or sounds that are obviously not being said, you know, when recorded, which is quite interesting.
And I think dialogue has obviously been changed, so that might, well, that might go back to your point, Stephen. So perhaps there was, but the end result is that nobody says anything. I get the sense that he doesn't want to be said in his film.
Mm-hmm.
But it has a particular, well, something that this makes me think. I mean, what other films came out in 1998? What are some
Like Matrix?
The Matrix, I was thinking that. Isn't The Matrix like,
I think so, The Matrix, what else? What was Spielberg doing by... Jurassic Park is earlier, right, surely? It's 94.
Yeah. Like Magnolia is the next year, 99.
What's Lynch?
Oh, yes, Lost Highway is 97. Okay. Right, so there we go. That kind of... Just watching this... Obviously, it's in black and white, and it's set in 1953.
Mm-hmm.
But I think for me as well, also something about the fact that the soundtrack is such that it is, it doesn't. It almost feels like it comes. I mean, it doesn't actually, because film from 1953 were nothing like this. But it does a weird dislocation that it does not. I mean, aside from all the obvious reasons why it doesn't feel contemporary with those films you've just mentioned
not at all,
from another world.
And even like for example, isn't Osos from late 90s?
Yes.
You know, so even like in the sort of, I would say, I mean, I may be completely wrong, you know, because I'm sort of here like hypothesizing, but I think even like when it comes to sort of the art cinema, you know, like the tradition was sort of like even like more like a Straujo yet of recording actual sound, right? You know what I mean? The idea of dubbing and stuff wasn't so much in vogue.
I guess the Bélotar films are done, I think, similarly, and they are at the same sort of time.
Mm.
It's difficult to place it. Is what we're finding.
Exactly, it's difficult.
You turn to your familiar art cinema auteurs who might share some correspondences, but he never quite sort of fits, and I think you can use the soundtrack as a great example of that, because on the one hand, the soundtrack is putting you in a very specific place and time, like a work of historical drama, much like the cinematography and the set design actually is materially very specific, and there's a bit of Tarkovsky there in the materiality of that, the dampness of it, for example, which is very Tarkovsky, but at the same time, Dominic said it's from another world, which makes me think of Hard to Be a God, which is set on another planet.
Mm.
And the sound is dislocated. And there are random ukulele notes throughout the film. Yeah. A lion roars in the park.
Exactly.
Yes, and that's something about Stalin, right? As a lion, it seems full of these.
That's a good one.
I get in this sort of sense that there's too, like, you can easily say, "Oh well, if we were Russian, we would get certain things," which we clearly would, but. But I can't believe that if you were Russian, you'd go, this film makes complete sense.
Yeah.
There's something Monty Python-esque and something Fellini-esque about that element of the soundtrack. But what I think he's doing is he's putting us in a year, you know, 1953, specific place and time, but he's distancing us from it. And he's saying there is something nightmarish about this particular time, you know, something that is distanced from reality, and that is state surveillance and its anti-Semitism, and it's the feeling you need to play a specific role, that life isn't as you think it is, and part of it is the difficulty of the film, part of it is, I suppose, being a Western audience and not, probably not knowing what it was like to live in 1953.
When there's clearly a satirical tradition, which this is, which I think is in Russian literature, that I don't know huge amounts of, but I have a sense of that I think this kind of fits into.
The way that some of these people behave and get away with, you know, I think something about power there, right? And about the sort of megalomania, right?
Well, a madness. It feels mad, but it doesn't do, again, what one might expect. I don't know, a Western or something. Like we said before how clearly, you know, at the end it seems to have this coda, which is 10 years later and things have changed, but it doesn't move from, I suppose it just moves from one kind of madness to a different kind of madness, which maybe is the political point.
So more melancholic or, more run down and less,
But it's mad at the beginning.
Yeah, and it's mad, it's always mad, yeah,
I mean, obviously mad is not a terribly... it's a terribly precise word.
But it's relevant because he's a doctor who does open brain surgery.
He's a neurosurgeon, isn't he?
Do you think like that some of this, the way it handles the eschatological thing, is that something that it's in the other film? Because I haven't seen it. But you know, the way that, for example, like, you know, characters randomly spit at each other or around.
No, as I say, I mean, if anything, there's even more of it in Hard to Be a God, because they're going around in mud the whole time, but you're like, well, I don't know if this is mud, you know?
Yeah,
like...
the reason I'm asking was because of the fact that he's a doctor and he's operating, you know? So some of the people are his patients, right? In some of the scenes. Mm. So you understand that they might be mad, you know? So well, it clearly, makes sense for them to, you know?
Clearly there are characters, clearly are in the sort of mental health wing.
Yeah. And their behaviour is in that way sort of justified. But then he also has traits of that, you know what I mean?
Right, so the point is there's not an easy distinction between... Exactly. Yeah.
But pretty much everybody, you know, there's nobody who is sane in a way, or like, you know what I mean?
Animals are definitely important, more generally, aren't they? There's the fish that the general magically revives by throwing him in the bath of water. And there are a few cats, and there's the dog that gets drunk... people are communing with nature, there's a sort of leveling off there. There's something about the, I suppose, the beastly nature of the way in which the people are kind of living.
It's the proximity. See, that made me think, thinking about the, the dog specifically. I always wondered if there were like specific, almost kind of parodies of Tarkovsky. In fact, there are a few things which I don't know if that. But so the dog drinks the whatever it is. I'm not sure it is beer. I think it's some kind of spirit. I think that he feeds it, which clearly is no good for it. But it happily laps it up, which reminds me of the dog drinking the milk in Stalker. The glass balancing reminds me of the end of Stalker with the glasses. The general's girlfriend's washing or hanging up, which is like those all those sheets in Mirror that hang, you know. But in every case, it's kind of, I have no idea if I'm just reading something into those. But if it is, it seems in every case it's kind of you know, what was something potentially somewhat transcendental is just made completely, you know, trashed.
There's no solemnity like in.
But there's also Buster Keaton, right? There's far too many people getting out of a car. Out of a sort of, it's not a car, it's a it's a kind of lorry.
Yeah, it's the KGB van.
Yeah, but it has a bunch of it has a load of logs on the back, so there's no back for them to come out of. The front, the cabin is small, but about 15 or 20 of them come out, which seems to be an explicit reference to the Buster Keaton.
Yeah, absolutely.
Gag. But I don't know why.
But I guess something to just do with the fact that the film is categorised as comedy drama on IMDb, but it's not. It's not a comedy film. I don't think it's funny, but that's not how I see it in those sort of generic terms.
No.
You know,
there's the Frederick Jameson article about this and Hard to Be a God that I was just from a few years back, and the New Left review that I was reading, and I think he might be kind of paraphrasing somebody else, but he describes this film, Cristello for My Car, he says that it's resists all aesthetic categories and reaches the limits of the tolerable.
Right.
I don't know, is that true? Does it reach the... Well, I think we could separate the two things, actually. Well, that, I don't know. I want to... Now I'm prejudging. Mm. Take the latter bit first. Do you think it... Let's see. What should I say? Does it...
I would say it does
resist... Does it reach the limits of the tolerable?
So there is that assumed... So there's some kind of film that's intolerable. Is that...
Ah, right. So this film could have gone further and then it would have become intolerable, but it's not intolerable that it reaches. But then what does it test our capacity to tolerate?
I find the musical moments quite, you know, I wouldn't say relaxing, but quite nice, you know what I mean?
Okay.
Like the melodies are, you know, it could be like, you know, they're easy to follow, they're likable,
right.
You know. There's a sort
but there's also one bit where there's like a string quartet or string group playing outside playing really, really badly, which is almost, it's quite funny. But there are, at the very least, you could say that, wouldn't it be fair to say there's so it's kind of few and far between those moments where the film lets you catch your breath and think about it.
When you said that sentence of reaches the limits of the tolerable, my first reaction was to say that, you know, that's wrong, that, you know, it could go farther, you know, you could, you know, you could, you think of films that, you know, are harder to watch in a way. But then I was thinking about it and I was like, well, you know, it's true in terms of, you know, it could be more violent or more grotesque, for example, but I don't know if I could take like another hour of that, you know what I mean? Like, you see what I mean? In terms of length, you know, could you watch like a, say, 5-hour film that behaves like this old, you know what I mean? I think you would actually would become intolerable.
Now, that's a really good point. Except it is a really good point, but then that's not quite, like, you wouldn't normally ask yourself, but, you know, let's say about a film that was just seemed as close to kind of purely enjoyable hours, an hour and a half. You wouldn't normally say, oh, but if this film was 4 hours, it would have been even better.
No.
But I know exactly what you mean. Like,
part of the issue is what's a universally tolerable, what's universally not tolerable. But you could say the film creates its own bounds in some ways, in that it often puts violence next to comedy and the bizarre next to harsh reality. And I find it difficult to let myself be at ease while watching the film, although I really do want to let myself go and enjoy the theatricality of the whole thing.
I think that's really interesting.
I feel like I also owe some kind of that I need to respect the context in which the film is set. You know,
which just made me think. Do you think one of the things is and why these things that we've just been saying are true is because so you can't. I can't see how you could watch this simply letting it, you know, wash over you because you'd be so bewildered. I feel it's like, you have to...
He doesn't let us anyway.
Yeah, right. You have to try and follow certain threads. And exactly, there are certain things. So in that sense, you can't just let it go, but it also forces you to let it go because there's so much at any one time that you simply will not be able to...
Yeah.
Encompass everything, so you're sort of forced to do two things at the same
time.
The film
is like one of those foul tasting pick me ups that he has to have after going through something traumatic. In that way, you know, it's kind of good for you, but it's difficult to accept that emotional curve that you're asked to go through is quite tiring. And I agree with Miguel. That for me is the exhausting element, and more than the duration, actually, is the actual.
Yeah, I don't feel it. I mean,
arc that this character goes through.
It's 2.5 hours. I mean, it doesn't feel short, but it doesn't feel
short
to me
to be good.
Enormously long.
No,
it feel like it,
no.
Yeah,
I would agree. It doesn't feel like it is longer than it is.
No.
There are some ways in which I wanted to say earlier in which the way the films are sort of, the film is sort of, almost. Anti-cinematography, like cinematography with a capital C, that's all about the craft of cinematography and the delicacy of cinematography, because it's doing so much. Because often you can't see what's happening because the character will physically block the camera, or the light is being refracted in so many directions. It just seems coincidental rather than
but
planned.
Also do other but it never is.
They take, for instance, the first shot of the general when he looks up to the camera with that benign face and he's bathed in light.
Yeah.
And it's shining quite hilariously off his bald head.
It's almost like you always need to add a but.
Yes.
I mean, like, it's slow cinema, but, you know, it's dubbed, but, you know.
Yeah, literally almost anything you could say about the film.
Same with the you know, like you say, it feels very premeditated and very calculated, but there's so much that, you know, you cannot, you know, possibly have, you know, expected every, you know what I mean?
Right.
It seems like unfathomable that you would, you know, design and...
Yes.
You know, intentionally place everything that happens in that film, but at the same time, it does feel,
or
it doesn't feel random, you know.
No, or reverse it, like we said earlier about the sound. You go, certain bits of the sound seem quite crude, it's used really carefully.
Yeah, it strikes me out. I think it's probably like one of those films that a lot of people would watch once, you know, be overwhelmed by it, dislike it, and, you know, just think it's bad or it's self-indulgent and won't give it. Because, you know, the first time I watched it, I was a bit like, you know, this... I thought it was absolutely random and that...
Mm-hmm.
That it, but then the second, you know, when you, like you say, when you have an idea of... There are plot points that you can follow and, you know, you can actually, like, engage with it in that way. And, you know, it opens up a lot of, you know, like, very interesting things.
I could imagine an interesting, like, you know, a book-length treatment of this film by someone who really knows... the cinematic and the political context. I mean, not that it's just about kind of catching the references, but I think it really would actually be... I think you get a lot of from the film without that, but I think it feels that it would also actually... To me, that would enrich it rather than kind of explaining away things. And, you know what it's a bit like, which maybe is obvious, it's only just occurred to me, it's a bit like those... paintings by someone like Bruegel or something, where you have, you know, those kind of... some town life with far more characters than you can possibly even take in, and and that sort of all life is here, although of course this is life is a very sort of distorted and corrupted thing because of what's going on, but still do you think that's right? No, there's something
there's something in that, I think, especially because you're referring to paintings, and I feel like a lot of the actors' performances are petrified. I mean, they seem to be doing the same thing. The guy who's whisking the eggs, or you'll see a patient just holding a bowl.
Yes.
You catch them for just 2 seconds. But what they are doing is very important for those 2 seconds. And
they're often in repetitive things, aren't they?
Repeat. There's that kind of that blurring a line between who's a patient and who's a civilian. And the neurosis of that. For me, it comes back to this idea of be careful how you act around public, almost to a degree of do the one thing that you do in a very outwardly sort of obvious way, and remember to blink, and look over your shoulder and check who's watching. For me, it's a political issue as well as an aesthetic issue. It's not all that, but I think that's an important aspect of it.
Also, do what the person with the overcoat tells you to do, even if it's completely stupid. But what you were saying about the faces, you know, that's true, but at the same time, there are, for example, the whole thing with the double.
Oh, yes.
You know, that, you know, you have those two guys that look like him, but don't quite, you know.
Yes, I mean. So the general has this. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, which is when I think he begins
to... Because one is a patient, right?
Well, I think... my understanding of that is that they're pretending he's a patient, but he's not a patient. That's one of the things that makes the general realise that he's next on the list for the chop, because they've got someone to pretend to be him to cover the fact that he's been arrested or something like that.
Yeah.
But of course, they're pretending that he's there for surgery. But I think that's a load of nonsense.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's my reading of it.
I think that's it. Yeah, I think there's some historical basis for that as well. I think body doubles were used. Thanks for listening to Discursion. It's been an absolute pleasure to work through this film. I think I need to see it a few more times. I don't know about you guys before I can really get to, I really want to revisit some of those tracking shots and. Just try and maybe look into the corners of the frame rather than directly ahead. Who knows what I'll see. But and thanks to Miguel.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Yes. And we'll be back with... I suspect we might choose something slightly less bewildering next time.
Yeah.
Or perhaps a differently bewildering. But...
differently bewildering film. Yeah, so if you are keen to hear that, subscribe to us on Spotify, iTunes, follow us on Twitter, and visit our Podbean homepage. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.